From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill in Baghdad questions the chief weapons inspectors, Blix and El-Bardi, about whether the bombing in the north and south no-fly zones are hindering inspections. Then the latest British intelligence report called Iraq its infrastructure of concealment, deception, and intimidation. But those charges could just as easily be leveled at Britain. The British government has admitted the so-called intelligence report, aimed at gaining support for a first strike attack against Iraq, was plagiarized from a U.S. student's doctoral thesis. The Justice Department is secretly drafting legislation that would strengthen the USA Patriot Act. The bill's provisions include allowing the government to strip citizenship from people who support groups the U.S. considers terrorist organizations and invalidating all municipal and state laws that regulate police spying. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Turkey has triggered unprecedented emergency consultations at NATO to seek help in defending itself in the event of a U.S. attack on Iraq. The move came after France, Belgium, and Germany blocked a U.S. request to begin boosting Turkish defenses. They argued that preparations to defend Turkey could undermine diplomatic efforts to avert a conflict in Iraq. In response, Turkey called an unprecedented emergency meeting today. Meanwhile, Germany and France have put forward a plan to triple the number of weapons inspectors in Iraq and possibly to place thousands of UN peacekeeping troops to aid the inspections. The Guardian newspaper of London reports that the Bush administration reacted last night with rage to the plan. The White House charged it was a thinly disguised attempt by France and Germany to derail the U.S. timetable for war. Secretary of State General Colin Powell warned if Saddam Hussein is still not cooperating with United Nations inspectors at the end of this week, President Bush would press immediately for a Security Council resolution authorizing war. War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld charged Saturday that countries which favored giving Iraq another chance are undermining what slim chance still exists to avoid war. Rumsfeld was in Munich, where thousands of anti-war demonstrators protested his presence by marching through Munich, chanting, "No room for Rumsfeld." In Baghdad, the UN chief weapons inspectors emerged from key talks with Iraq officials yesterday, saying they saw signs of a, quote, change of heart from Iraq over disarmament demands. The inspectors, Hans Blix and Mohammed El-Baradei, added that further UN inspections were preferable to a quick U.S.-led military strike. Blix told the Associated Press, "We are not at all at the end of the road." He added, "I would much rather see inspections than some other solution." On Saturday, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan warned the United States not to declare war on Iraq without Security Council agreement. During a speech at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia, Annan said, quote, "What happens in Iraq does not take place in a vacuum. It has implications for better or worse for other issues of great importance to the United States and to the world. Those issues include the struggle against international terror, proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, and a host of other burning conflicts, from the Israeli-Palestinian dispute to Afghanistan and wars in Africa." And at the Vatican, Pope John Paul II called for additional efforts to avoid a war. He's scheduled to meet with Iraqi Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz on Friday. The Justice Department is quietly drafting legislation that would vastly strengthen the government's already sweeping powers granted by the USA Patriot Act. Under the bill, the FBI and local police forces would be given more power to spy on domestic groups. The Justice Department would create a DNA database of possible suspects, and U.S. citizens could be stripped of their citizenship and expatriated for providing material support to a group designated by the government as terrorist. A draft copy of the legislation was obtained by Charles Lewis of the Center for Public Integrity. We'll be talking to him in a few minutes. Doubts of the validity of U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell's reports to the United Nations continued to rise over the weekend. The London Observer reports journalists visited northern Iraq, where Powell charged there was a poison and explosives training center. They found a half-built cinder block compound filled with heavily armed Kurdish men, video equipment, and children, but no obvious sign of chemical weapons manufacturing. Also this weekend, a British academic uncovered that British officials had plagiarized large portions of its alleged intelligence report. Portions of the text were lifted from a graduate student's research paper and from the publication of Jane's Intelligence Review, much of it coming from 12 years ago. We'll speak to the British academic who uncovered this in just a few minutes. The White House and Turkey have reached a deal that will allow Turkish troops to occupy a part of the Kurdish self-rule area during a war to oust Saddam Hussein. U.S. officials have claimed a limited Turkish deployment in northern Iraq would be for humanitarian reasons and that Turkish troops there would be under control of a U.S.-led coalition. 10 Nobel Prize-winning economists have publicly condemned President George Bush's tax policies, predicting that the government would suffer record budget deficits if the White House proceeds in cutting taxes while increasing spending. Meanwhile, the New York Times is reporting that the White House is considering a plan to abolish the income tax in favor of a consumption tax. According to the Times, a consumption tax would obliterate the idea of a progressive tax system and shift much of the tax burden from the rich to middle-income people and the poor. On Saturday, India and Pakistan staged tit-for-tat expulsions of their top diplomats, deepening a chill between the nuclear-armed neighbors. A total of 10 diplomats were ordered out of the two countries. In Indonesia, a Scottish academic was released yesterday after 5 months' imprisonment for violating her tourist visa. The woman, Leslie McCullough, was arrested after she was caught leaving the villages of Aceh. Upon her release, McCullough acknowledged that she had lied during her trial to protect her contacts in the Aceh separatist movement she was accused of conspiring with. A colleague of hers, the American nurse Joyce Sadler, was released last month from jail. They had been beaten up by the Indonesian military as they were taken into jail. In Puerto Rico, the U.S. Navy announced Saturday it had conducted its final bombing exercises on the island of Vieques. Protesters drove in a convoy of about 100 cars through civilian areas honking horns to celebrate the day. The Navy had used Vieques as a testing range for 60 years, despite international protests. The U.S. Navy has begun taking out online employment ads and offering $6,000 bonuses in an attempt to get morticians to enlist. One ad on hotjobs.com reads, "Experience in all facets of the funeral industry is a plus, with emphasis placed on technical ability." The Navy denies the search has anything to do with a possible war in Iraq. And protests continue around the world against war. In Indonesia, 100,000 people took to the streets to protest a U.S. invasion of Iraq. In the U.S., 2,000 anti-war demonstrators gathered in Ann Arbor Saturday. In Burlington, Vermont, 12 citizens staged a die-in in front of a local mall. In West Los Angeles, up to 200 students faced possible suspension for walking out of class last week to protest war. And hundreds gathered in Cleveland, Ohio for an anti-war conference. In the Netherlands, a Dutch woman smashed 3 satellite dishes with a sledgehammer at a NATO airbase to protest a possible U.S. attack on Iraq. And in New York, United for Peace and Justice, the coalition group preparing for the march on Saturday, have received city approval to hold an anti-war rally on February 15th near the United Nations. But the New York police have rejected a permit for a march, citing security reasons. A judge is expected to rule today on the group's appeal of the police rejection, but the group does have a permit to rally just outside the United Nations.
The military and the monetary get together whenever they think it's necessary. They turn our brothers and sisters into mercenaries. They are turning the planet to a cemetery. The military and the monetary use the media as intermediaries. They are determined to keep the citizens secondary. They make so many decisions that are arbitrary. We're marching behind the commander-in-chief, who was standing under a spotlight shaking like a leaf. But the ship of state had landed on.
Gil Scott Heron, Work for Peace, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. Fresh from a visit to Baghdad, Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix says today he sees no new evidence of Iraqi weapons. He rejected European suggestions that more inspectors would help in the hunt. Democracy Now! Reporter Jeremy Scahill questioned the inspectors at their news conference yesterday in Baghdad.
The Chief UN Weapons Inspectors Hans Blix and Mohammed al-Baradei left Baghdad today, saying they had found no smoking gun. They called on the Iraqi government to continue its cooperation with the weapons inspections process and, in fact, to increase that cooperation. The inspectors said that Iraq was showing a greater willingness to cooperate with the inspections regime, but they said that Baghdad had not delivered the kind of dramatic breakthrough that could effectively halt the march toward war, if, in fact, anything could. Now, there are just days to go before the next defining moment in this crisis is in front of the world, and that is on February 14th, when Hans Blix and Mohammed al-Baradei return to a UN Security Council that sees an increasing threat from Washington of a unilateral attack on Iraq if the UN does not give the United States UN authorization to do it under the UN flag. The inspectors leave Iraq today with a number of issues that they say are still outstanding, one of them being the interviews of Iraqi scientists by the UN weapons inspectors. They have been calling on Baghdad to allow the scientists to be interviewed outside of the presence of an Iraqi government official. Many Iraqi scientists have said that they do not want to do that, and they have, in fact, requested Iraqi officials to sit in on the meetings and to also make sure that the meetings are tape recorded. Well, over the last several days, several Iraqi scientists have been interviewed outside of the presence of Iraqi government officials. The weapons inspectors hailed this as a good step forward, but said they wanted to see more of it. Another major issue that is outstanding is the issue of the United Nations weapons inspectors' request that they be allowed to send aerial spy aircraft over Iraq to do surveillance of sites around the country. The Iraqis have said that because of the regular bombing by the United States and Britain in these so-called no-fly zones, that Iraq cannot ensure the safety of the aircraft and that they fear some kind of an incident would be sparked by the United States to lead to a massive bombing of Iraq. Now, Hans Blix expressed what I think many could see as cautious optimism on the situation. He said that over the 2 days here, he saw a beginning to take disarmament issues more seriously on the part of Baghdad. He also said that the recent Iraqi moves, and this was echoed by Mohammed al-Baradei, were what he called a change of heart on the part of the Iraqis. And they pointed to these private interviews, as well as the fact that Iraq has just handed over to the inspectors a number of documents that are detailing what Iraq says is its destruction of its stocks of anthrax and VX nerve agents. But the inspectors say that while these are welcome, that the documents are not records of the alleged destruction of the agents, but that they are new documents explaining how Iraq had gone about the process of destroying these agents. Now, both Hans Blix and Mohammed al-Baradei said that they are continuing to advocate for the continuation of the inspections as an alternative to a military attack against Iraq. They said that this is what the world is calling for. And Hans Blix himself said that he had seen a large banner when he arrived in Baghdad that called for UN inspections, not a U.S. invasion. That banner was held by members of the Iraq peace team and voices of the wilderness. Hans Blix saying that that echoed the calls around the world. Now, Mohammed al-Baradei, for his part, said he believed that the inspections here would continue as long as Iraq made what he called quick progress in its level of cooperation. Baradei saying the ball is very much in Iraq's court. As long as we're negotiating good progress, I think the Security Council, in my opinion, will continue to support the inspections process. That from Mohammed al-Baradei. Now, after the last round of meetings with the Iraqi officials last night, Mohammed al-Baradei and Hans Blix addressed reporters inside the heavily fortified UN compound in the Canal Hotel on the outskirts of Baghdad. First, you're going to hear Mohammed al-Baradei, followed by Hans Blix, responding to a question from the press on George Bush's recent statement that the game is over. Here first is Mohammed al-Baradei.
But the two important issues, which again, both substance and process for us, is the interviews and the surveillance. And I think we are moving on one, that's the interviews. And we hope very much before Friday again to move on the question of the surveillance plane, because that again will show the Security Council that full cooperation, transparent system, intrusive system. But I see all this, as I said, as as a beginning of a change of heart, and a beginning of a different attitude, and I hope this new attitude will be tested in the next few days and weeks, because time is of the essence.
That was Hans Blix, the head of UNMAVIC, saying that despite Bush's comments about the game being over, that the inspectors are still very much in the game. Now, another major issue that is still unresolved is the issue of the ongoing bombing by U.S. and British warplanes in these so-called no-fly zones. Just this past weekend, U.S. warplanes bombed again in southern Iraq. This is no-fly zone. These no-fly zones are the longest sustained bombing campaign since the Vietnam War. They are not authorized by any Security Council resolution and, in fact, have been called illegal by many international law experts. The Iraqis say that they are reluctant to allow the overflight of U-2 spy planes or other spy aircraft as part of the inspections regime, because Iraq says that these ongoing attacks by the U.S. and British warplanes mean that Iraq cannot guarantee the safety of the U-2 flights in its own territory because of the regular invasion of the U.S. and British warplanes. Now, Dr. Amir Saadi, the special advisor to the Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, said earlier this week that he feared what he called another Gulf of Tonkin. In other words, that the U.S. would shoot down one of its own U-2 spy planes in the no-fly zones, blame it on Iraq, and then use that as the pretext for a war, because the U-2 planes would be flying under the U.N. banner. They also, the Iraqis say that as part of their right to self-defense, that they intend to continue firing on American and British warplanes that come into their territory. They say that it's one of the key components in this crisis of maintaining their sovereignty, and they fear that they would mistakenly shoot down a U-2 plane, thinking that it was an invading U.S. aircraft, something that they feel could also spark a massive bombing on Iraq. But over the last 24 hours, there has appears to be a willingness on the part of Iraq to consider allowing these. But this remains one of the questions that is being unasked by reporters of Hans Blix and Mohammed al-Baradei, that they represent the UN Security Council here in Iraq, and the weapons inspections process is authorized by the Security Council, and yet they are doing these inspections while the U.S. and Britain are regularly bombing the country. So at the press conference last night, I had the opportunity to ask Hans Blix about these so-called no-fly zones.
Question one is that Hans von Spanik, the former head of the UN Humanitarian Office here in Baghdad, has said that there is no mandate whatsoever at the UN for the no-fly zones and calls them illegal. So I'm asking, are you going to, as part of the negotiations, call for an end to the irregular bombing by British and American warplanes? And then the second would be, did Colin Powell violate Resolution 1441 by presenting evidence that he didn't give to either of you prior to his 90-minute presentation?
No, we have nothing to do with the no-fly zone. There is nothing in the resolutions that are setting up my organization to discuss and to deal with the no-fly zones. The legal views are divided on that, so we do not enter that. The resolution does not make any reference to it, although it was well known that they existed at the time. So we think that we are entitled to do what the resolutions say. Did Colin Powell violate the resolution by not telling us in advance? Well, the countries, member countries, are recommended to give us all the information that they have. Now, that recommendation that they will have treated in their judgment. We do get the good information, as I mentioned to you, from the United States and other countries, and other information they will not give. There's some information they won't give at all to anybody, because they worry about the sources, and we understand that.
That is the chief UN weapons inspector, Hans Blix. After he responded to those questions, I tried to follow up on it, but I was cut off by his press attaché, and they went on to another reporter's question. So filmmaker Jackie Suen and I managed actually to get inside the UN compound after the press conference, where we saw Diane Sawyer from ABC and Harry Smith from CBS and Nick Robertson from CNN. All of them were inside the compound. They had been invited for private meetings with Hans Blix. We had not been invited to any of those meetings. And after the chief weapons inspector, Hans Blix, emerged from these interviews with the major corporate networks, we approached him in the hallway and continued asking those questions that are being left out of the mainstream discussion on this crisis.
George W. Bush, as well as Colin Powell and Donald Rumsfeld, have said that inspections are not the issue, that Saddam Hussein's regime is the issue. Do these kinds of statements undermine your ability to complete your work here?
I don't think so. I think results will prove. If we have results, it will count. And if we don't, well, that will undercut us.
Can I ask you to answer my question that I asked you in the press conference, and that is, will you ask for the U.S. and Britain to stop bombing Iraq in the no-fly zones as a measure of good faith in this process with Iraq?
No, we have nothing to do with the no-fly zones. We are operating exclusively under the resolutions that give us a mandate, and that's for the U.S. and the rest of the Security Council, not just.
Are they hindering your work, though, Dr. Blix, the no-fly zones?
No, we are asking the Iraqis to give us permission, or rather, not permission, but at any rate, to give a green light, a positive attitude for us having all the kinds of planes.
That, again, is Hans Blix. Though we had more questions for him, he was then whisked away by his security. Another member of the UNMAVIC team, an American, then approached us after Hans Blix was taken away, and he told us sternly that the inspectors have never had any problems because of the so-called no-fly zones. He refused, however, to answer any more of our questions. Jackie Suen and I then headed back to the Iraqi Ministry of Information, where General Amir Saadi, the special advisor to Saddam Hussein, was responding to Hans Blix and al-Baradei and talking about the visit over the last several days here. And we continued pressing on this issue of the U-2 overflights, and we asked General Amir Saadi to respond to the statements given to us by Hans Blix.
Hans Blix said tonight that UNMAVIC has nothing to do with the no-fly zones. And he also said that he would not directly ask for a halt to the U.S. and British bombings. Is your position, given what you said the other night about Gulf of Tonkin and another incident, is your position that you would not be willing to allow the U-2 flights unless there's a ceasing of the bombing?
I said that there is a new way of looking at this problem in connection with a whole range of three other, let's call them for the time being, surveillance platforms. One American, one China, Russian, and one French. In that context, we could see a possibility, because then such incident cannot be so easily arranged or engineered, as I mentioned. And this is being carefully considered, seriously, and we promised to come up with a solution before Friday.
You might be willing to allow these flights even with the regular bombing of the U.S. and British planes. Is that you're saying you're open to that possibility?
Doesn't that imply that? I mean, I have answered your question.
That was Dr. Amir Saadi, the special advisor to the Iraqi President Saddam Hussein and the liaison from the Iraqi side with the weapons inspectors here in Baghdad. So the word from the Iraqi government is that they now appear poised to allow the surveillance planes to fly over Iraq, despite what Baghdad sees as a major risk of sparking a war, another Gulf of Tonkin, as the Iraqis put it. Clearly, Baghdad hopes that this is going to win them points and embolden the growing calls globally for a continuation of the inspections process and not a U.S. invasion. Now, Hans Blix last night also dismissed as rumors reports that the French and German governments were brokering a secret plan as an alternative to a U.S.-led war against Iraq. The plan, according to the German publication Der Spiegel, said that the French and Germans hoped to deploy U.N. Blue Helmet soldiers, peacekeepers in Iraq, and have the number of weapons inspectors tripled inside the country. According to the report, some 150,000 U.S. soldiers that are based around Iraq's borders would remain in place to ensure what one official called the peaceful invasion of the Blue Helmets and to secure their mission. As part of this reported plan, the French Mirage reconnaissance planes, as well as German unmanned planes and the American U-2 spy aircraft, would all fly over Iraq. Now, Hans Blix dismissed these last night as rumors, as I said, saying that he had had a phone call, and he didn't say who it was with, that confirmed for him that these are rumors. Now, this all comes as the Sunday Telegraph of London reported that the United States and Britain are drawing up plans to give Iraqi President Saddam Hussein as little as 48 hours to flee Baghdad or face war as part of a second UN resolution. The newspaper said that such a resolution could be put before the UN Security Council by this next weekend. The Iraqis, as well as most countries around the world, are basically praying for a miracle right now. This Friday, when Hans Blix and Mohammed al-Baradei return to the Security Council. It will be a defining moment in this crisis without much question at all. And as the inspectors left Baghdad today, ordinary Iraqis are certainly feeling the situation becoming more and more desperate. As the Muslim holiday of Eid begins tomorrow, marking the end of the religious pilgrimage, or Hajj, Iraqis know that in the coming days there will likely be very little to celebrate. For Democracy Now!, this is Jeremy Scahill in Baghdad.
And you are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we will look at a Justice Department attempt to vastly expand the powers of the USA Patriot Act.
Right before I close my eyes at night, I think, sense, feel, man, like I'm under some kind of microscope. Satellites over my head, transmitters in my dollars, hawking, watching, scoping, shocking, scrutinizing me, checking to see what I'm doing, where I be, who I see, how and where and with whom I make my money. What is this? Excuse me, miss. May I have your phone number and your social security?
Jill Scott, watching me here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. The Justice Department is drafting legislation that would strengthen the already sweeping powers granted by the USA Patriot Act. Under the bill, the government would strip citizens of their citizenship and expatriate them if they provide material support to a group the government calls terrorist. All municipal and state laws that regulate police spying on domestic groups would become invalid. The bill would automatically deny bail for anyone accused of terrorist-related crimes. All governmental agencies would be barred from releasing any information about individuals detained in so-called terrorism investigations. A DNA database would be set up to include suspects not convicted of any crimes. The bill is entitled the Domestic Security Enhancement Act of 2003, and a draft copy was obtained and released by the watchdog group Center for Public Integrity. Charles Lewis is its executive director in Washington. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks.
It's good to have you with us. Well, can you just explain what it is that you found?
Well, I mean, what we found is, you know, as you were just describing, a fairly remarkable draft piece of legislation written in the last, well, they've been developing it quietly for several months, and when we obtained it, what was most stunning to us was that no one on the Hill, it appeared to us, by the way, in either party, for months, they'd been hearing that there might be possibly something, but they were also told there might not be anything, and here we had a detailed 100-plus page summary and draft of the legislation, very carefully written by the same person who has claimed credit for writing the first one, the first Patriot Act. And so we were fascinated both by what's in this thing, but also the prospect of when did they think they were going to release it, and could it be related to events in Iraq. And so anyway, the whole thing is fairly amazing.
Can you say who wrote it?
It's not 100% confirmed, but it appears that it's Viet Dinh, head of the Office of Legal Policy inside the Justice Department. He's the one who has claimed credit for writing or being the architect, at least, for the first Patriot Act, and it appears that he's been at it again.
So let's talk about some of the aspects of this bill entitled the Domestic Security Enhancement Act of 2003.
Well, I mean, I think, to me, some of the most stark things are, as you were just noting, that the presumption that when you're detained now for terrorism, there will be no information released, period. So Freedom of Information Act requests have just been sealed off officially and formally. This is, they're tired of all those requests, and they're flatly stating they'll never release that information until charges might be brought. Bear in mind, as you know, that over 1,000 people were detained, and I don't think a single person was charged criminally since September 11th. So that's clearly a pretty controversial issue. There's a worst-case scenario thing that I find very interesting where chemical companies that have a requirement under the EPA to file these worst-case scenario reports for local communities about toxic emissions or things in the name of health and safety are now, that information is now going to be restricted. There'll be new freedom of information restrictions inside the EPA about that information. So local community folks are going to have a harder time getting that information. And this is an old chestnut that the chemical industry has wanted for years, and now it's part of the terrorism, you know, follow-up Patriot II legislation. There's a lot of increased surveillance. For example, now law enforcement can pull all credit card and financial information. Believe it or not, that actually has not been the case up till now. They are claiming that they would like the same latitude in pulling all of everyone's credit histories as private companies, who can do it in a matter of seconds or minutes, that they would like to also have that authority. So they're, as you know, with Patriot One, it increased surveillance generally on all Americans because of, you know, looking, you know, for terrorism suspects, but giving them wide latitude, making more murky the lines between foreign intelligence and domestic law enforcement even further. And you know, the Attorney General can basically decide that someone should be expatriated if they're with a group that has fallen into disfavor or is regarded as a terrorist organization by the Attorney General. One of the most disturbing things is judicial oversight has been limited. Now the Justice Department can go in and make ex parte communications directly with these Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act FISA judges, these, you know, secret intelligence courts. Now, instead of saying that the court may hear from them, it says that they will hear separate conversations directly with the judges from the government. And so in this and some other ways that others know far more about than I do, it appears that what they're trying to do is further restrict information to the public, but they're also reducing the latitude that any judicial court might have over any of these decisions. And so while they're increasing their surveillance and law enforcement capabilities, they're also reducing basically oversight and review, I guess you'd say, by various, in the case of the judicial review that I was talking about. So this is a 40-section thing. This is massive. I've only mentioned a few things in it, but there are things in this legislation I think will be kicked around for months and frankly ought to be.
You know, I was wondering, you put this out on your website on Thursday, is that right?
Actually Friday afternoon around 3.
I was wondering if what was the cause for the heightening to the amber alert or the orange alert on Friday? And I could think of two things. One was the massive peace protest planned for New York so that they could say that there's too much of a threat for it to be and not grant a permit, though they have granted one now. The other was somehow distracting attention from your report or showing the justification for this expanded USA Patriot Act?
Well, I think it's a really interesting question. I mean, I don't know what was going on over there. I do know they were scrambling to try to defend this. One of the things that we got a hold of, we did some things with Bill Moyers' program Now, and they actually obtained a routing slip that showed that this draft January 10th went to the Speaker of the House, Dennis Hastert, and Vice President Cheney. And the Justice Department on the afternoon on Friday was trying to describe it as just a very preliminary draft, not that important, that the Attorney General hadn't seen it. But then we had a routing slip showing that it went to the brass a month earlier, which was something they did not appreciate. And then they said, well, that just doesn't mean they received it. It just means there's a piece of paper saying that. So there was a lot of scrambling by them. And so are they capable? I mean, is any administration, and including this one, capable of what you just described? I think we're all pretty hard-bitten, and we all have plenty of scar tissue. Yes, it's possible. And I just don't know the answer. It's a really interesting point, though, and yes, it occurred to me.
While we're on Cheney, the General Accounting Office, Congress's investigatory arm, has abandoned its effort to get records of Vice President Dick Cheney's energy task force, right? All the energy companies that basically determined energy policy in this country. You had done a lot on that at the time, your response.
Right. Well, no, I I'm not a constitutional scholar. I thought the General Counting Office had every right to try to get that information. I mean, these are meetings on public property with public officials paid by taxpayer money discussing public policies that affect our lives. The idea that we can't know who was in the meetings on the government property is just extraordinary to me, and I just pinch myself in incredulity that would even be discussed or even challenged by anybody. And a judge did uphold the position of the vice president, and GAO chose not to pursue it. And there were some hints in at least the Washington Post account that David Walker, the GAO comptroller general, was under enormous pressure, which I'm sure he was. You know, GAO, as you know, is a watchdog agency, part of Congress. Now Congress is completely controlled both houses by the Republicans, and the budget for the General Counting Office is controlled by the Congress and, yes, the Republicans. And I don't know what went on there, but he chose not to pursue the appeal, and I've got to think that there were conversations and things. Hell, I think Walker's a good man. I think what he did was courageous, and I think a lot of people were disappointed to see them stand down on this, because I think there's a principle involved here.
Charles Lewis, we're also joined by David Cole, Georgetown University law professor, author of Terrorism and the Constitution, Sacrificing Civil Liberties in the Name of National Security. Your response to this release of the document that is a bill that would seek wider anti-terror powers, as the Attorney General puts it.
Well, I agree with Chuck. It's very troubling, and it's particularly troubling that the government appears to have had this in a pretty final form and not put it out on the table where it could be discussed in a somewhat rational form. And certainly the speculation is that they were waiting until there was a war with Iraq, when the president knows that he can get whatever he wants, to introduce it. And of course, you know, people play politics with the timing of the introduction of legislation all the time, but it's one thing to play politics with a farm bill. It's another thing to play politics with a bill that's really going to reshape the constitutional rights and liberties of the American people for a long time.
Under the draft, the government could declare individuals, not just groups, foreign powers, subject to clandestine surveillance under looser standards that would apply in criminal cases, and it would permit such surveillance against a U.S. citizen suspected of spying for a foreign power, even if the alleged suspicious conduct was not itself criminal. Can you explain that? I was reading from the New York Times.
Yeah, well, that's basically they're using the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and they're expanding it. One of the things the Patriot Act did was to expand it so that it could be used in criminal investigations. And what the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act does is give the government the power to conduct secret wiretaps and secret searches without probable cause of a crime. One of the things that I find interesting about this bill is when you look at in comparison to the Patriot Act. The Patriot Act, Congress and the president basically said, "Look, international terrorism is a threat. It's a matter of foreign intelligence. It often involves foreign nationals. So we need to focus our efforts on foreign nationals, foreign intelligence. That justifies broader surveillance." Then, when you look at this bill, what you see is that they have now said that if a U.S. citizen so much as donates a penny to an organization which the Attorney General determines to be a terrorist organization, that person is presumptively stripped of his citizenship, turned into a foreign national, essentially made an alien, and then he would be subject to deportation under a separate provision of the new bill on the Attorney General's determination that his presence here is inconsistent with our foreign policy or economic interests.
Deported to where?
Deported, well, that's and then, of course, where would you deport a stateless person? And what they've said...
They were a citizen of the United States. They're a citizen of the United States.
Well, he wouldn't be a citizen of the United States anymore. He'd be a stateless person. And there are plenty of stateless persons, most of them Palestinians, who are ordered deported. And what the government alleges it can do with respect to them is detain them until it finds a country that will agree to take them. So it's really a pretty sweeping thing. And, you know, the Patriot Act was named to suggest that if you opposed it, you were not a patriot. This bill goes further and says that if you are in any way associated with a group we don't like, we will make you a non-citizen, and then you're subject to this tremendous power of the immigration authority.
A DNA database would be set up to include people not convicted of any crimes?
That's right. They suggest a DNA database that would include some people convicted of crimes, but would also include people who were merely suspected of belonging to these various quote-unquote terrorist organizations, and would also include a whole range of non-citizens who didn't belong to any group but who were suspected by the Attorney General of being dangerous in one way or another. And so we'd take their DNA and put it into this new federal database.
And the issue of all municipal and state laws that regulate police spying on domestic groups becoming invalid?
Right. This is very troubling. I mean, basically, they're trying to terminate in one fell swoop all the Red Squad litigation, which had led in many cities, was spawned by the abuses of the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, had led to injunctions and decrees that forbade illegal police spying. Well, this bill would automatically terminate any consent decree that was entered before September 11th, 2001, no matter what the legitimate basis for the consent decree. It would end, and that would affect in New York the Hanshu case, which is under litigation right now.
Well, I know that Charles Lewis has to go, and I still want to ask you, David Cole, about the Zacharias Moussaoui case, the attempt to halt proceedings against him now, the Justice Department wanting to put his case into a military tribunal. I'm going to ask you that after the break, but I want to say goodbye to Charles Lewis, Executive Director of the Center for Public Integrity. You have posted what you found on your website, which is?
www.publicintegrity.org, O-R-G, and the full text of this thing is available.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining
us. Thank you. Take care.
You too. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll continue with David Cole on the Zacharias Moussaoui case, but then we're going to England to talk to an academic researcher who exposed the British so-called intelligence report that Colin Powell cited in his reason why the U.S. should be able to attack Iraq. This researcher found that the so-called intelligence report was based on a years-old academic paper from a grad student here in the United States. Stay with us.
Feel, man, like I'm under some kind of microscope. Satellites over my head, transmitters in my dollars, hawking, watching, scoping, shocking, scrutinizing me, checking to see what I'm doing, where I be, who I see, how and where and with whom I make my money. What is this? Excuse me, miss. May I have your phone number and your social security? Who, me? When all I came to do was buy my double or triple A batteries? Please, I decline.
Watching me, Jill Scott, here on Democracy Now!, Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. In just a minute, we go to Cambridge University in Britain. But right now, David Cole, still with us, Professor, Georgetown University Law Center. A federal judge is considering a government request to halt proceedings against Zacharias Moussaoui until an appeals court rules on national security issues. Moussaoui, accused of conspiracy in the September 11th attacks, faces the death penalty in a trial that is scheduled to begin in June. But last week, the New York Times reports federal judge Leone Brinkema secretly ruled that Moussaoui's lawyers must be allowed to question a captured al-Qaeda suspect named Ramzi bin al-Shib. CBS News reports the ruling is based on the constitutional right of defendants to conduct discovery that might help provide them with a defense. Prosecutors have described bin al-Shib as a central intermediary between Moussaoui and the September 11th plotters. The government is balking. Federal prosecutors have asked the trial to be halted until an appellate court can review the judge's ruling. According to the New York Times, the Bush administration will almost certainly abandon the civilian trial and move the case to a military tribunal if the judge's ruling stands. David Cole, your constitutional lawyer, what's your response?
Well, you know, I think the notion that when you're putting someone on trial for death, that he ought not be able to talk to a person that the government has in its custody who may very well have exculpatory evidence, evidence undermining the charge of guilt. That's a crazy notion, and the government is now seeking an appeal from the judge's ruling. The judge's ruling makes perfect sense. If this person, Mr. Bin al-Shib, has information that might help Moussaoui, he has a constitutional right to access to that person, and of course the government has control of this person. So I think if you're going to go ahead with the death penalty in a criminal case, you've got to give him access to that person. On the other hand, I do think that the military, you know, in a military situation, when you've captured a high-level guy from the other side, you don't necessarily want to be giving all kinds of people access to that individual. And so there is a legitimate national security concern on the other side, and the real question is, how do you deal with that? You know, often we deal with that in the sort of ordinary course of things, by dropping charges, by reaching plea agreements, which is what they did in the John Walker Lynn case, by pursuing using different evidence and the like, pursuing different charges. But I think it's a tough call for the government, because they do have to provide this information if he's going to have a fair trial, but they don't necessarily want to be providing it right now.
And moving it into a military tribunal?
Yeah, I think, well, one option would be to hold him as an enemy combatant, and then to hold him until such time as which they feel comfortable in giving him access to Mr. al-Shib, and then you can go forward with a fair trial. I think if you move him into a military tribunal for a purpose of continuing to seek to impose the death penalty but denying him a fair opportunity to defend himself, then that's very troubling.
David Cole, Georgetown University law professor, author of Terrorism and the Constitution. And now we turn to the latest British intelligence report. It's called Iraq. It's infrastructure of concealment, deception, and intimidation. Right now, those charges could just as easily be leveled at Britain. The British government is struggling to recover from acute international embarrassment after admitting that much of its latest intelligence report on Iraq was plagiarized from a California grad student, spelling and punctuation errors and all. The British government released the report last Monday. It said it was based on, quote, intelligence material. On Wednesday, Secretary of State General Colin Powell praised the report as he argued for war in his presentation to the UN Security Council. But then 28-year-old Cambridge University lecturer Glenn Rangwala discovered that much of the report was stolen from an American student's doctoral thesis. The student, Ibrahim al-Marashi, wrote the thesis based on Iraqi papers abandoned in Kuwait some 12 years ago. Rangwala sent an email to two Cambridge students who forwarded it to journalists. He also discovered the so-called intelligence report appeared to have been cobbled together not by Middle East experts, but by Alistair Campbell's secretary and other assistants. Alistair Campbell's the British government's chief spin doctor. Glenn Rangwala joins us now, a lecturer in politics at Cambridge University in Britain. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you with us. So can you talk about this paper that the supposed intelligence report of the British government is based on?
Yes. Okay. They released a 19-page dossier on Monday last week, a week ago today, in which they purported to give an accurate assessment of the current state of Iraq's so-called infrastructure of concealment, the mechanisms that Iraq has in place to hide weapons that it has from inspectors. Now, pages 6 to 16 of this 19-page dossier are taken directly from three different articles that have been written over the past 7 years. And one of them, the one that's most taken from, actually dates its primary sources to 1991, so it's using information that's 12 years old. Most of the dossier is lifted directly from these works. So as you mentioned, typographical errors, inconsistencies in spelling, and even incorrect grammar are just taken and reproduced as so-called intelligence information on Iraq today.
And how did you discover this?
Oh, it was quite easy. I'm an Iraq analyst. I lecture in Middle East politics, and so I'd read the original articles. To be honest, there's not that many people who write on Iraq's security and intelligence structures in the English language, and so I recognized the vast majority of it straight away and could pin it down to the three specific articles without too much difficulty. One interesting thing is, because it's taken from different articles, in some cases they take parts from one article and parts from the other article and patch them together. And in one case, at least, they've done this incorrectly. So they have a section in the British dossier on an organisation called the Military Security Service inside Iraq. Now, they've taken the first paragraph from one author, and then they've taken another section from a different author, but they've taken it from the wrong part of the article. So they've reproduced a section on the General Security Service from one author under the title of the Military Security Service, and this has rendered in a completely incoherent statement of what this organisation is about. Now, Colin Powell yesterday was saying that it may have been plagiarised okay, but we still consider it to be accurate. Now, clearly, in some cases, like this case about the Military Security Service, that is simply not the case. They've reproduced incorrect information and patched it together in a very bad way. And that is clear from the nature of the dossier.
You also point out that the Iraqi Directorate of General Intelligence that the student writes about is information that he got during the Persian Gulf War. So it's not up-to-date information about what Iraq is doing.
Absolutely. In that case, it's information that's 12 years old. And I think what's relevant about this is that this being presented as current information, one has to question to what extent past statements by the British and to some extent the American government about facilities that they claim are currently in place in Iraq, say either factories for the production of non-conventional weapons or facilities that Iraq has developed over those past 12 years, are also taken from similarly sloppy sources. Sources which are no longer applicable to the present day or are in fact talking about completely different things. And I'll give you one very clear example in the Powell speech last Wednesday to the Security Council, where he talks about one section about how Iraq has experimented using chemical and biological agents on political prisoners, and he mentions that 1,600 people have been subjected to this. Now, reputable human rights organizations such as Amnesty International say that they have records of Iraq doing this from the 1980s, and that is a wholesale violation of their human rights. But this was in the 1980s. Powell is presenting this as information about what is currently going on in Iraq, and one must question to what extent they really do have intelligence in this field, because Amnesty International, at least, the organization who I think have most intelligence about what the current human rights situation is in Iraq, say that there is no record of Iraq doing this during the 1990s or subsequently. So this isn't just about, as it were, one hastily cobbled together British report. It is about the whole nature of American and British claims to intelligence about what is currently going on inside Iraq.
We're talking to Dr. Glenn Rangwala, who's a lecturer in politics at Cambridge University. You also point out that in the section that was lifted from Mr. Marashi's paper that appeared in the Middle East Review of International Affairs last September, it's the same except for a few tweaks. Can you talk about how they changed the wording?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. So Marashi's paper is written in mostly academic language. So it refers quite precisely to the current structures in place that were in place inside Iraq in 1991. Now, this has been modified and elaborated on by the British government in changing specific words in order to make these institutions seem, I suppose, more threatening than Marashi himself portrayed them as being. So one very clear example, Marashi gives details of one particular organization inside Iraq and says that it has between 10 and 40,000 agents working for it. Now, the entire section is lifted entirely for the British government's official dossier, but instead of saying 10 to 40,000 agents that are a part of this organization, they say 30 to 40,000 agents are working for this organization. So they've effectively just taken the same information but exaggerated the numbers to make it seem more threatening than Marashi himself thinks they are.
So now let's talk about the author of the British report that Colin Powell cites in his case for war and the reaction in Britain, like the Conservative Party's shadow defense secretary, Bernard Jenkin, who says that the government's reaction utterly fails to explain, deny, or excuse the allegations about the plagiarism. He said the document has been cited by the prime minister and Colin Powell as the basis for a possible war. Who is responsible for such an incredible failure of judgment?
Indeed, yes. You see, to one extent, the discussion in the UK is really focused around the plagiarism charge. So isn't this terrible that the British government has just taken some grad students' work and passed it off as its own? And that's a valid concern. I think much more significant is the whole question about what this says about British intelligence's contribution to the propaganda and the justification for war. Last week, Tony Blair himself was claiming that there were links between al-Qaeda and the Iraqi government, Saddam Hussein's government in Baghdad. Now, a report was leaked from the intelligence services themselves to British journalists, which said that there is no evidence for this link between al-Qaeda and Baghdad, but that Tony Blair essentially was as it were, making this up in order to substantiate a political point. And there is word that within the British security services there is quite a great deal of dissatisfaction with the way that the British government is either ignoring or completely going against the very information that it supplies to the British government. And one must question whether this is exactly the same sort of thing going on with the whole weapons inspections issue, where the agencies, the intelligence agencies, are given one perspective to the government that Iraq is actually largely in compliance with the weapons inspectors, with the British government then coming out and saying the opposite, that there is this, in their terms, an infrastructure of concealment. So one can say that maybe it is the case that the intelligence services reports are actually indicating something contrary to what the British government would like to say, and that's why it has to get its press people to concoct these disgraceful reports that it put out about.
I'm looking at a piece in The Guardian. It says, disturbing reports. The government has issued three reports, talking about the British government, in the past 6 months, trying to establish a case for action against Iraq, each progressively drawing more criticism. September, 50-page dossier, Iraq weapons of mass destruction. The assessment of the British government relied heavily on input from the Foreign Office and the MI6. The material was damning, but most of it turned out to be years old. British journalists in Baghdad visited several facilities of concern highlighted in the report and found nothing sinister. December, the 23-page Saddam Hussein crimes and human rights abuses provided horrifying account of abuses, but was widely criticized by human rights groups, MPs, and others for recycling old information. At the launch, the Foreign Office had on the platform an Iraqi exile who'd been jailed by President Saddam Hussein for 11 years. Later, he disclosed that handcuffs he had worn had been made in Britain.
Indeed, yes. With regard to the Human Rights Report, it was widely denounced by the human rights organizations for being opportunistic. This was a government that, during its most brutal period of repression during the 1980s, was strongly supported by the British government, who sold the weapons that it needed to engage in the repression of its own population and to fight the war against Iran. When it no longer became useful, the British government starts putting out these dossiers about how terrible Iraq was during the 1980s. And in some cases, as you mentioned, it tries to infer from that statements about how currently Iraq is operating, which is actually substantively different from how it engaged in repression during the 1980s. There have been quite widespread changes in the nature of Iraqi governance and Iraqi society over the past few years. It's still an extremely repressive government, which nobody in their right mind would want to justify the actions of. However, the level of the repression has actually changed quite substantially and decreased in many aspects over the last 12 years.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Glenn Rangwala, lecturer in politics at Cambridge University in Britain. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a cassette copy, video or audio, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is www.democracynow.org. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. I'll be on CNN Wolf Blitzer's program today at 12:30 Eastern Standard Time, talking about Iraq and the peace movement in this country. Just came from Cleveland, another city that's passed a resolution against war. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Nogueira, Alex Wolf, Mike DeFlippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song, and I'll try not to sing out of key. Oh, I get by a little help from my friends. Ooh, I get high a little help from my friends.